Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. I'm Bill Scanlon. It's 1 week to Election Day, and Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and their campaign surrogates are out in force today making their closing arguments. We'll hear some of that next after a quick look at news headlines. A federal judge in Washington ruled today the Department of Justice could not represent President Trump in a defamation lawsuit brought by journalist E. Jean Carroll, who has accused the president of raping her in the 1990s. The DOJ sought to take over the case last month, arguing the president was acting within the scope of his employment. A U.S. district judge in Manhattan, Lewis Kaplan, ruled that the president was not acting in his official capacity when he denied the allegations against him. Police shot and killed a black man in Philadelphia yesterday, sparking a night of unrest and violence. The Philadelphia Inquirer writes that police struggled to respond to vandalism and looting along the commercial corridor of 52nd Street. By morning, an officer was hospitalized in stable condition with a broken leg after being struck by a pickup truck. About 29 other officers suffered mostly minor injuries from being struck by rocks, bricks, and other projectiles. Police shot Walter Wallace Jr. Monday while he was reportedly brandishing a knife. After yesterday's Senate confirmation, her swearing in on the White House lawn last night, new Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett recited her judicial oath this morning, administered by Chief Justice John Roberts, and went to work. During her brief comments last night, Justice Barrett said, quote, "A judge declares that independence not only from Congress and the president, but also from the private beliefs that I might otherwise move her. The judicial oath captures the essence of judicial duty." CNN reports that lawyers for Pennsylvania County filed a petition with the court today asking Justice Barrett to recuse herself from an election-related case. This after the court late yesterday blocked Wisconsin's attempt to extend ballot deadlines in that state. Just for your information, too, our coverage of the Barrett nomination and confirmation process, all of that in our video library at cspan.org. President Trump is making it a full day of campaigning today in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nebraska. His first stop, a rally in Lansing at their Michigan's Capital Region International Airport. The president talked about his new Supreme Court Justice, Amy Coney Barrett.
You know, I introduced a great justice of the Supreme Court last night, right? They say it's the most important thing a president can do. I say maybe military, but regardless. We've rebuilt our military like nobody would ever believe. But you know what? It's one of the most important, especially because this turns the court. They had a whole thing, most important thing in 50 years. And CNN and MSDNC didn't cover. They didn't cover. They wouldn't cover. They just couldn't, even though the ratings go through the roof. 60 Minutes had very good ratings the other night, a fake report, but the ratings go through the roof. But they didn't cover my introduction. Can you believe that? My introduction of a woman that's going to be there hopefully for 50 years, as far as I'm concerned. And last night we did. We made history and we confirmed Amy Coney Barrett to the United States Supreme Court. And Justice Barrett will defend our rights, will defend our liberties and our God-given freedom. She's going to be fantastic, and she's a terrific person.
And at that Lansing, Michigan rally, the president also addressed how his administration has handled the response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Can't watch anything else. Turn on COVID, 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 COVID. Well, we have a spike in cases. You ever notice they don't use the word death, they use the word cases, cases. Like Barron Trump is a case. He has sniffles. He was sniffling. One Kleenex, that's all he needed. One, that was it. And he was better. But he's a case, okay? He's a case, Barron Trump. Young people, cases. And you know why we have so many cases? Because we test more. So we go around, and they're a very, by the way, we're testing very young people, too. We're testing people in school. We're testing everybody. In many ways, I hate it. In many ways, I hate it. We test everybody. And because of that, now, if I tested half, if I said, we are going to cut our testing down in half, they'd go crazy. Because the cases would go down in approximately half, right? And then we're going to cut it down in half once again. And there are other countries that don't do testing, and they show very few cases. I mean, it's a very simple thing. But overall, it's good to have the testing. We find out where it is, and there are a lot of things. But they use it to make us look bad. But here's the story. It's COVID, COVID, COVID. You can't watch anything else. On November 4th, you won't be hearing so much about it. Okay? November 4th. On November 4th, you'll hear. It's getting better. It's getting better. You watch. No, no, they're doing heavy COVID because they want to scare people. And people get it. I'll tell you, they understand these people better than you are smarter than most of the political people in this world. You get it. Get it. Very smart.
That Michigan stopped the first of three rallies President Trump is attending across the U.S. today. Also on the itinerary, West Salem, Wisconsin later, and Omaha, Nebraska tonight. At Joint Base Andrews, as he was departing for the rallies, President Trump spoke with reporters.
Well, we have Omaha, and we're right next to Iowa, and I've done well in Nebraska, and I'm doing well there right now. But you do have, you know, you have Nebraska, too. You have Omaha, and that's something that a lot of Republicans don't get, and I'd like to get it. Nebraska won, you know, I'm way up. But Nebraska, too, I'd like to get it, and it's something that a lot of Republicans don't get. At the same time, I'm right by Iowa and the farmers. You know, we got the farmers $28 billion. So we're very, we're doing very well, as I understand, in Iowa and in Nebraska. But we're looking at that Omaha region. That's why we're there.
And by the way, we will have live coverage of President Trump's rally in Omaha, Nebraska tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, here on C-SPAN Radio, on C-SPAN Television, and online at cspan.org. On the Democratic side, Joe Biden is in Georgia today. First stop was Warm Springs, where he spoke about divisions and differences in the U.S. and the lessons of FDR.
The insidious virus, the economic anguish, the systematic discrimination. And one of them could have rocked the nation, any one of them. Yet, we've been hit by all three at once. But if we're honest with ourselves, the pain striking at the heart of our country goes back months, not months, but years. Our politics has for too long been mean and bitter and divisive, and you can hear it now in the distance. We've stopped seeing dignity in one another. We've stopped showing each other respect. Too many among us spend more time shouting than listening, more time fighting than working together, more time demonizing and denigrating others than lifting them up. The divisions in our nation are getting wider. Angry people are upset. Anger and suspicion are growing, and our wounds are getting deeper. It may, and many wonder, has it gone too far? Have we passed the point of no return? Has the heart of this nation turned to stone? I don't think so. I refuse to believe it. I know this country. I know our people. And I know we can unite and heal this nation. Warm Springs is a good place to talk about hope and healing. Sir Franklin Roosevelt came, quote, to use the therapeutic waters to rebuild himself. Stricken by polio, the polio virus in 1921, he suffered from paralysis. Like many other Americans of those pre-vaccine decades, FDR longed to live an independent life, a life that wasn't defined by his illness. To him, and to so many others facing physical challenges, Warm Springs offered therapy for the body, and I might add, and the soul. But it offered something else as well. FDR came looking for a cure. But it was the lessons he learned here that he used to lift a nation. Humility, empathy, courage, optimism.
Joining us is Greg Bluestein, who's politics and government reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You were covering Joe Biden's event today at Warm Springs, Georgia. Why was he there?
Well, he was there for a couple reasons. He was there to give his closing message, a message that bookends the speech he had earlier this month in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And this was a speech about bipartisanship, about healing, about recovery from a divisive time in American politics. But he was also there because Georgia is truly a battleground, because poll after poll after poll, including the Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll out on Monday, shows this race in a dead heat, in a deadlock, a statistical tie. However you want to frame it, is a very close race. And it's not just Democrats who are saying this, it's Republicans too, which is why President Trump was here just a few days ago as well.
Before we go on to what's happening in Georgia today, remind us again of why Warm Springs is such an iconic place for Americans, in particular, though, for Democrats.
Yeah, great question. Warm Springs is a tiny town of just 400 people, a town that I hadn't even been to as a lifelong Georgia until today. It was just kind of embarrassing to say. But it's where President Franklin Roosevelt had his private retreat. It was called the Little White House, and he spent years there. So much time there, actually, he used to write a column for the local newspaper, the Macon Telegraph, way back when. And he actually died in 1845, where he died at Warm Springs. But it's known for its healing waters, its therapeutic treatments. And it was a place that he found, he saw as a respite from the White House and from Washington and all the politics. He would go to Warm Springs to kind of get away from it all.
You would mention the polls tightening in Georgia, that you called it a battleground state. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris is running it. It made several stops in Georgia. What's been the reaction, both there in Warm Springs and other events that have happened for the candidates in Georgia?
Yeah, Republicans kind of say been there, done that. I mean, they've been through cycles in 2014 and 2016 and 2018 where Democrats threatened and they kind of put them away. But the difference this year is that, yes, in 2014 and in 2016, Republicans had pretty easy victories, including Trump's 5-point win in 2016 without even visiting the state in the final stretch. 2018 was a different story. 2018, Brian Kemp, the governor, Republican governor of Georgia, only won by about 55,000 votes over Stacey Abrams. And so that was the first major sign that, okay, not only is Georgia close, it is razor thin close. That was the closest gubernatorial election in Georgia in decades, and two other statewide races for lower seats went into runoffs in Georgia. And so everyone kind of came into the cycle knowing that it was going to be very, very close, not sure how the pandemic and how President Trump would electrify that, intensify that, I should say. But certainly it has. And now there's no doubt that Georgia is kind of hanging on a razor's edge right now. Polls show literally, you know, they can't be closer, like a tie, a straight-up tie, or just a few fractions of a percent apart, you know, well within the margin of error.
But the story that's gotten national concerns attention over the last couple of years, voting concerns continue to be an issue in Georgia, from the race you mentioned, Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp in 2018, to the long lines, the early voting lines here in 2020. What is the Biden campaign saying and doing to address those concerns?
Yeah, great point. The Biden campaign is saying essentially have a plan to vote. The national message, too. Now there's multiple ways to vote in places like Georgia. Of course, there's election day voting when lines are expected to be very long in some polling precincts. There's also mail-in balloting, which has always been allowed in Georgia. And of course, there's 3 weeks of early voting. And already all that early in-person voting is setting a record. About 3 million people have so far cast an early ballot in Georgia. That's shattering records. I mean, it's blowing through records. And turnout's expected to exceed 5 million, which would also shatter turnout records in Georgia. We saw a glimpse of that during the primary where there was no statewide Republican race on the ballots, but we saw sky-high enthusiasm from Democrats. We also had sky-high lines. Mm-hmm. We had lines of 8-9 hours in some polling precincts. It was a very big concern, you know, because there's different ways of voter suppression, as Democrats like to point out. It's not just, you know, voter ID or some of the traditional methods that they criticize, but it's also a lack of polling precincts. It's a dearth of computers, of voting machines. It's ill-trained polling volunteers. All those can contribute to these long lines that we saw back in June, and then they're hoping we don't see in just a week.
Yeah, and on those numbers, I think it was a New York Times piece I was looking at in terms of so far there in Georgia, some 70% of the entire number who voted in have voted so far in 2020, 70% of the 2016 number. Obviously, early voting is driving that Specifically on Election Day, what are you expecting? More long lines and delayed voting, or at least delayed closing the polls possible?
Look, we'll definitely see long lines. And anytime you see long lines, anytime you see voters who bring lawn chairs as an accessory to vote, there's a problem. And that's what's happened in Georgia. But I think the good news is that our data and the data we've seen from early voting and polling data suggest that two-thirds or more of the Georgia electorate will have already cast their ballots by then, which is a huge change. It's a sea change. You know, usually you're closer to 50% of that mark. So if you're at two-thirds plus, that means that the bulk of the electorate will have voted. Still no excuse for long lines and any of the problems we might see on Tuesday, but at least we'll know that most of the electorate will have cast their ballots by then.
We'll have to get back to you to talk about the senatorial races, but Greg Bluestein, covering it all there in Georgia, politics and government reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You can read more at ajc.com. He's on Twitter at Bluestein. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And back to the campaign trail on the Republican side. In her first in-person campaign event of 2020, First Lady Melania Trump rallied supporters of her husband in Atglen, Pennsylvania. She was joined by former presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway.
Donald is a fighter. He loves this country and he fights for you every single day. For the first time in history, the citizens of this country get to hear directly and instantly from their president every single day through social media. I do not always agree with the way he says things, but it is important to him that he speaks directly to the people he serves. This administration chooses to keep moving forward during this pandemic, not backward. By moving forward, we demonstrate a fundamental value of our nation, our ability to rise to any challenge and overcome any hurdle. We do not close down or hide in fear. We get to work to find real and lasting solutions. It's what sets us apart from any other country in the world.
Former President Barack Obama campaigned today for Joe Biden in Florida and visited a 2020 coordinated campaign victory center in Orlando to greet volunteers and supporters and thank them for their work. He also spoke to a drive-in Biden campaign rally in Orlando.
More than 225,000 people in this country are dead. More than 100,000 small businesses have closed. 500,000 jobs are gone in Florida alone. Think about that. And what's his closing argument? That people are too focused on COVID. He said this at one of his rallies. COVID, 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 he's complaining. He's jealous of COVID's media coverage. If he had been focused on COVID from the beginning, cases wouldn't be reaching new record highs across the country this week. If we were focused on COVID now, the White House wouldn't be having its second outbreak in a month. The White House. Let me say this. I lived in the White House for a while. You know, it's a controlled environment. You can take some preventive measures in the White House to avoid getting sick. Except this guy can't seem to do it. He's turned the White House into a hot zone. Some of the places he holds rallies have seen new spikes right after he leaves town. And over the weekend, his chief of staff said, and I'm quoting here, I'm not making this up. His chief of staff on a news program says, we're not going to control the pandemic. He just said this. Yes, he did. And yes, we noticed you're not going to control the pandemic. Listen, winter is coming. They're waving the white flag of surrender. Florida, we can't afford four more years of this. That's why we've got to send Joe Biden to the White House. because we cannot afford this kind of incompetence and disinterest.
News reports today indicate that the Trump campaign is changing its advertising campaign strategy in Florida. This as the Lincoln Project, a group of Republicans opposing President Trump and his reelection, has released another ad, one that starts with the sound of an election night.
You asked me to wake you and tell you what happened in the election.
Who won?
Trump. Trump won.
But I thought you could only be president 2 times.
Not anymore.
And that ad from the Lincoln Project at the end, the crowd chanting 12 more years on screen, the message, stop him or it will never stop. Vote him out. The ad from the Lincoln Project. The numbers are down on the Dow Jones again today, falling 222 points to close at 27,463.19. The S&P also off 0.3%. But the NASDAQ is up 0.6% with tech stocks leading the way. You're listening to Washington Today for Tuesday, October 27th, 2020, here on C-SPAN Radio. It is Washington Today for Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. In a conversation today hosted by the Washington Post, Coronavirus Task Force member and HHS Assistant Secretary for Health Admiral Brett Giroir talked about the rise in COVID-19 cases across the country and the timeline for a vaccine, commenting that, quote, Americans will not be fully immunized at least until mid-2021.
I think we're very comparable to what was going on in July and August. So testing may be identifying some more cases. I think that's clearly true. But what we're seeing is a real increase in the numbers. Now, back in March and April, we were probably only detecting one out of 10 or one out of every 15 cases. So you can't really compare today to back in March and April. But compared to the post-Memorial Day surge, even though testing is up, this is a real increase in cases. We know that not only because the case numbers are up and we can calculate that, but we know that hospitalizations are going up. But to put it in perspective, there are several areas of the country where hospitals are becoming full and being stressed. But we're still at about 41,000 people in the hospital with coronavirus compared to a high of 76,000 in July. So, we really have a mixed picture, but we are tenuous now. We really have to re-engage the public health measures that we know works, or those hospitalizations can go up substantially. The good things that we know is a lot more younger people are getting it than older people, which is one reason why the hospitalizations are shorter. And we do have some effective therapies that we can apply against it. But there's nothing that we're going to do that's better than preventing infections in the first place. And those are those public health measures we talked about until we get a vaccine. Vaccines are coming. We are very encouraged that there are now 4 open phase 3 trials. Preliminary data look good. But this is not going to be here tomorrow. We may get the first vaccines out this year. We're certainly hopeful for that. We're hopeful that they would be useful in screening the elderly, for example, protecting the elderly and the most vulnerable. So even if we only have a few million vaccines, we might get most of the benefit. But the American people will not be fully immunized, even if everything goes well, at least until mid-2021. So we have to be very disciplined about our mask wearing, avoiding crowds, particularly around the holidays. It doesn't have to be hundreds of people, but you know, a family gathering of 20 or 25 or 30 still means that we have to be careful about our interactions, about our hygiene, and particularly if there are vulnerable people within our family.
And more on the COVID-19 vaccine front. General Gustav Perna is Chief Operations Officer for Operation Warp Speed, the Trump administration's plan for logistics and delivery of a vaccine. He spoke earlier at a Heritage Foundation event.
Four tenets of the distribution strategy that I gave the team as we were working planning was, first and foremost, we needed to understand, we need to have visibility and control of all vaccines. We needed to know where every vial was, whether it was in the factory or it was on a truck or it had been distributed down to administration site. We must have 100% accountability of all vaccines every day. Second, we must be able to track the uptake of vaccine to persons out in America. Two reasons for this. First and foremost, because there, five of the six are two-dose vaccines, we need to make sure that people are registered to the vaccine that they were administered and that there is fail-safe checks and balances to make sure when they come back 21 or 28 days later that they get the right vaccine for their second dose. The second point was, is we want to manage the flow of vaccine to the American people. Initially, we're going to have tens of millions of doses available come December, but come January, February, March, it will quickly and exponentially increase to hundreds of millions of doses. So it'll be essential that we maintain the right flow of vaccine to the American people, so tracking the uptake. Third, we must make sure that we have traceability of the vaccine and that we know where the vaccine is going at all times. It'll be a hot commodity, of course, and we needed to get to the places where it will be distributed based on state priorities and requirements in accordance with the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine. And then last, we want to be able to cover all parts of America, whether you're in the Pacific, in the remote islands in the Pacific, or down in the, in the Atlantic. We want to be able to get to those islands. We want to be able to get to all of CONUS America, whether it's in the metropolitan cities or rural America. And we want to be able to make sure we can distribute to those American citizens who are overseas, you know, serving in the Department of Defense or State Department, et cetera. So we had to have coverage.
A Wall Street Journal opinion piece published yesterday was headlined, "Winter is coming, time for a mask mandate. A requirement to cover your face in public could be more of a cultural norm than a political statement." The author of that piece was former FDA Administrator Scott Gottlieb, calling for a national effort on wearing masks. He was asked about that today at a discussion hosted by The Hill.
You tweeted out recently that you thought it was time for a national mask mandate. Do you see any way that leading Republicans and leading Democrats might come together and say, given the dark winter we're looking at potentially, that this might be the right time?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how you would enforce a national mandate. I think that there are Republicans that are on board with trying to promote mask wearing. And I think that there's ways you could provide carrots rather than just sticks to try to prod governors to implement those mandates. Certainly, if you made it more culturally acceptable, that would be a very big start. And so, you know, the bully pulpit is very powerful. And I think if it was used in a way to try to encourage governors to do this, that would go a very long way instead of what we have right now, which is in some cases the opposite, where masks are being discouraged in some respect. You know, remember, the masks are to prevent asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people from being able to transmit the virus. They can also offer you protection as an individual, but their quality of mask matters. And the higher the quality of the mask that you're wearing, the more protection it's going to afford you.
Federal Communications Commission Chair Ajit Pai today defended his plans to move forward with a rulemaking to clarify Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which protects social media companies from being legally liable for what their users say and do on their platforms. President Trump and other Republicans have again called for Section 230 to be revoked after Twitter and Facebook recently restricted distribution of a New York Post story about the business dealings of Hunter Biden, son of Joe Biden.
We'll take our next question from David Shepardson with Reuters. Thanks for having the call. I was tempted to direct my question to the bulldog, but I'll ask you, Chairman. I want to stay on the Section 230 for a second. At the last monthly meeting, you said that you were waiting for the staff to complete their review, and this was operating in the ordinary course. And then you opted to put that statement out in a very busy week where a lot was going on. Justice Thomas issued an opinion. I can't remember if it was an opinion or a dissent. And Twitter froze the account of the New York Post and prevented various entities from posting the link. Can you explain sort of, did you have a change of heart in terms of your timing? And also, can you respond to the criticism from your two Democratic colleagues that suggest you're not being consistent by moving ahead on Section 230 while at the same time relying on 230 for the net neutrality repeal?
Sure. I will be happy to take the question, David. Ginger is otherwise occupied at the moment. Otherwise, she would have been happy to take it. But look, you know, the comment cycle on the petition closed in the late middle part of September. As you pointed out, Justice Thomas appended a statement to a Supreme Court case in which he expressed his view that Section 230 is being interpreted too broadly. As I mentioned in my own statement, members of all three branches of government have expressed a concern about this issue and are looking at potential reforms. And our general counsel, on top of that, informed me that we have authority to take action. And as I mentioned in response to the previous question, the legal thinking that he outlined has now been made public in favor of transparency. And moreover, look, it has been obvious for a long time that these companies have a viewpoint and they use that viewpoint to discriminate. I talked about that in 2017 and 2018. So this is not a new issue by any means. With respect to the consistency point, this is entirely consistent. We are not talking about imposing regulations on social media companies. Instead, we are talking about interpreting an immunity provision that is part of the law.
That's FCC Chair Ajit Pai. Earlier today, The Hill is reporting this afternoon that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg will express support for reforming Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act during a Senate hearing on the online liability law. According to testimony reviewed by The Hill, he says, quote, Section 230 made it possible for every major internet service to be built and ensured important values like free expression and openness were part of how platforms operate. However, I believe Congress should update the law and make sure it's working as intended. Part of the testimony reported by The Hill of a hearing coming up tomorrow, the Senate Commerce Committee holding a hearing on Section 230 with Mr. Zuckerberg and other witnesses, the heads of Twitter and Google. Our live coverage begins at 10 a.m. Eastern here on C-SPAN Radio, and you can listen anywhere on the C-SPAN Radio app. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo signed a military agreement today in India before heading to Sri Lanka on a multi-country tour. Secretary Pompeo was joined in New Delhi by U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Together, they signed a pact with their Indian counterparts to share sensitive satellite data, often used to steer missiles and drones. It's the latest in a series of U.S.-India military agreements designed to counter China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific region.
Thanks to Prime Minister Modi and President Trump's leadership and our shared values, our ties are growing stronger day by day. This morning, we visited the National War Memorial to honor the brave men and women of the Indian Armed Forces who have sacrificed for the world's largest democracy, including 20 that were killed by the PLA forces in the Galwan Valley in June. The United States will stand with the people of India as they confront threats to their sovereignty and to their liberty. As to our discussion these 2 days, look, our joint efforts to fight the pandemic, which we talked about at great length, are a strong signal that our nations are committed to working together and expanding our partnership across many fronts. U.S. health agencies are working closely with government partners of India on the COVID-19 response. Indian companies, too, are cooperating with Gilead to manufacture remdesivir for use by low- and middle-income countries all around the world. And several Indian and U.S. companies are working together to test and manufacture potential vaccine candidates. Further, I'm proud to announce today new agreements between the United States Department of Health and Human Services and the Indian Ministry on Health and Family Welfare to enhance health cooperation. It could not come at a better time. The challenge of defeating the pandemic that came from Wuhan also fed into our robust discussions about the Chinese Communist Party. Our leaders and our citizens see with increasing clarity that the CCP is no friend to democracy, the rule of law, transparency, nor to freedom of navigation, the foundation of a free and open and prosperous Indo-Pacific. I'm glad to say that the United States and India are taking steps to strengthen our cooperation against all manner of threats, and not just those posed by the Chinese Communist Party.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Well, that's Washington Today for Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. We're back live tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Eastern, simulcasting C-SPAN's Washington Journal. If you missed any part of today's Washington Today, you can find it on the free C-SPAN radio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your evening.